This is Sequitur, an exploration of the natural consequences of our actions at the individual, community, cultural, and species levels. Sequitur is brought to you by Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. I'm Susan Livingston, your host and producer. Sequitur is archived under the Expressions of Peace tab at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action. Sequitur, the theme song, is by Zymph. That's Z-Y-M-P-H-T. You can find more of his music on SoundCloud. Sequitur, it follows. Sequitur began production in April 2016 to provide extreme weather coverage and climate disruption updates while Extinction Radio was on hiatus. Inspired by Guy McPherson's Nature Bats Last, the focus of Sequitur expanded to consider the overarching issue of habitat loss. Sequitur's content further expanded under the influence of Derek Jensen's book, The Myth of Human Supremacy, to cover extinction events and their drivers for the whole web of life rather than only property destruction and loss of human life or monetized livelihood. The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History by Elizabeth Colbert, and Columbus and Other Cannibals by Indigenous historian Jack D. Forbes have provided additional conceptual underpinnings. Aho, Metakwe Owasan, we are all related.
Inspired by anticipation of future events, I took Sequitur out of the archives 11 months ago to produce Protection, a live shamanic ceremony. The inspiration for this show, Interbeing, is a blast from the past. 7 years ago, I hosted a teleconference with Charles Eisenstein as the featured guest for a global community called Embodied Compassion. That's before Sequitur was even a twinkle in my eye. Before my shamanic awakening, before I lost my housing in Berkeley and eventually migrated back east. It was in the wake of his publication of the seminal Sacred Economics, before he moved to Asheville, North Carolina, just a couple of months before I ended up returning there too, before his new and ancient story podcast was even a twinkle in his eye. You can find links to that podcast and to his other writing and workshop offerings at charleseisenstein.net. As you will hear implied on the recording, the title of this teleconference event was a matter of some controversy. Charles's writing at that time was all about emerging from the age of separation into the age of reunion. So if I remember correctly, he wanted to call our event Overcoming Invisible Habits of Separation, or maybe Dissolving Invisible Habits of Separation. Say what? Has anybody ever heard of a visible habit? Besides, maybe you've noticed that I favor short titles. Charles prevailed at that time, but for the Sequitur context, the one-word title Interbeing works better, I think. I had fortunately downloaded the recording of that Embodied Compassion teleconference to store it on my SoundCloud, but I subsequently removed it when I needed those megabytes for a theatrical production project. I had done a tasteless editing job on it, reducing a 90-minute call to 42 minutes. And when I re-expanded it to fit the Sequitur format, the sound quality really suffered. Well, to make a long story short, in the course of searching through old MP3 downloads for something unrelated, I found the original unedited recording. That gave me far superior raw audio to edit, but it still has that unmistakable telephone quality. It also cost me 3 extra days of work and 2 headaches to edit the raw recording. So it is with great delight that I present this sample of the early Charles Eisenstein, perhaps the first time he ever presented in cyberspace.
I was thinking what I'm going to do is I'm going to maybe speak and then invite questions and just kind of do it like that. Otherwise, it's kind of weird to be just talking and no one to be in the line and I wouldn't even know it. So I think maybe I'll start about just like, what am I talking about when I say habits of separation? Like, what is separation? And what I'm talking about here, you could say it's an ideology, but it's more than an ideology. It's also a way of being, a way of seeing, a way of relating to the world that has been taught to us by our culture and beyond our culture, by our whole civilization. And in fact, it's a way of being that has created our civilization and that our civilization also creates. The first thing I was thinking as you were talking about there must be obstacles, these habits of separation, that already triggers one of the habits of separation, in me at least, which is kind of this, uh-oh, there's obstacles, and I'm going to have to do something about them. And doing something, really when I break it down, it means overcoming them through some kind of force that I exert on myself. And I go through this whole thing where I feel ashamed of these obstacles, and I strive to do better and all that stuff. And I want to say that that whole mindset is actually one of the obstacles. It's almost hard to find the right vocabulary. The obstacles are overcome or dissolved in a very different kind of way than through this campaign of self-improvement with all of its tools of guilt and shame and rewarding yourself and praising yourself for having made progress and all that kind of stuff. All of that is one of the obstacles. You could say that it's a revolution in means as well as in ends. Whether it's on a personal or a collective level, a social level, the old strategies of revolution, which basically come down to overthrowing the tyrants with force, aren't working very well anymore and lead to despair because we realize that the tyrants have way more force than we do. And every culture has a mythology that answers the question, what are you? Who are you? Separation is the story or the mythology. And it says what you are is this separate being in an external universe among lots of other separate beings who are not you. They're outside of you. So they're either fundamentally indifferent to you, like these arbitrary forces of nature, or they're hostile to you or competitors to you. Because after all, you're trying to protect your welfare. They're trying to protect theirs. And more for you is less for me. And from this mythology of separation, which goes back hundreds, if not thousands of years, you know, it's the idea of a skin-encapsulated soul or a mind or a consciousness kind of encased in flesh. It's in religion, it's in science as well. It's that you're a kind of a flesh machine programmed by your genes to maximize reproductive self-interest. In every field, we have kind of this different version of the separate self. And it has created pretty much everything that we see around us, our technology, our medicine, our educational system. In various ways, it comes from this story of separation, and it's creating crisis. It's creating disaster. For example, our separateness from nature is destroying the planet because we're treating nature as exactly what I said. Like, you know, it's not me. These other beings out there, they're not me. So whatever I do to them, well, as long as I can insulate myself from the effects and there's no reason to expect I can't, then it doesn't matter what I or what we collectively do to other beings. Even if we exterminated all of the other species, we could synthesize food and create an artificial atmosphere or something like that, right? So they're not fundamentally us. So that's what I'm talking about with separation. And I think that probably everybody on this call understands that this story, this mythology, this way of being is becoming obsolete. And, you know, on one level, we don't resonate with it anymore. We don't want to be separate from everybody else. We crave to reconnect with nature. We crave to reconnect with each other. We want community again. So we are rebelling against this. And scientifically, it's falling apart too. And I could go into how it's falling apart in physics and biology and psychology and all that. But I'm just going to assume right now that people kind of get it, what I'm talking about with separation, you know, that we all want to reconnect. But it's not so easy necessarily to reconnect because we have a lot of habits that are based on separation and also the institutions that surround us, especially the money system, are based on separation. And they kind of enforce behaviors that are of the old story, of the old world of separation. And that's why I like to explore the ways in which I'm still living from that place of separation. And so I explore those ways and share with other people ways in which they've noticed that they're still in separation. And by shedding light on these things, you know, a lot of times things, when they're ready to dissolve, they rise to the surface so that they're exposed to light. The invisible becomes visible. It's still there. But once it enters awareness, then it begins to dissolve. It's kind of like its last stage. So that's really what I want to do today is I want to shed some light on these things and hear from other people too. so that we can do that for each other. How does that sound?
Sounds great. Are you ready for the first round of questions?
Yeah, let's pause here and take a few questions or comments.
Okay, so if you have a question or a comment that you'd like to address to Charles, please press 5-star on your telephone keypad and I'll hand you a mic. Jim, you have a mic.
Yes. Charles, I'm reading your book and loving it, but it feels to me like you're imagining that the change process that's required for us to overcome this separation is an individual one, that somehow that we as individuals will awaken, and enough of us, and then this change process will happen. I see it more as a collective process. Maybe you could say more about that.
Yeah, I think that the individual process and the collective process are tightly interlinked, and they mirror each other. So, like, what puts someone through the individual process? It's not usually, in my experience, that somebody makes some enormous effort and through their own willpower and general enlightened excellence goes to some change process. But it's when life kind of falls apart and the way that I was doing things doesn't work anymore. Only when that happens am I ready for something new. And then I don't even know what the new thing is, but I have a sense of what it is maybe. And then somebody comes and gives it to me through their example, or I'll have some experience that gives me a glimpse of this new world that I'm now ready for because the old world's falling apart. That's a very common pattern, maybe universal on the individual level. And on the collective level, I think that we're going through the same thing, that the way our society has been doing things isn't working anymore. And just like me, when it becomes apparent that it's not working anymore, I cling all the more tightly to the way that wasn't working, hoping it'll start working again. So you could look at our society and like the policy of bailing out the financial system and waiting, hoping for this return to normalcy, you know, and hoping that everything's going to start working again the way it used to. Like, we're still kind of clinging to that old world even as it falls apart. And so I see, like, collectively we're going through the same thing that people go through individually. And the collective falling apart hastens the individual falling apart because people are losing their jobs, for example, or the healthcare system's falling apart and people are losing their health, or civic society is unraveling, people don't have community anymore, and that makes people's marriages fall apart. And so the falling apart, you know, on every level mirrors all the other levels. So, Jim, I'm not sure if that really answers your question. Do you want to follow up on that? Or
I guess my sense of it, Charles, is that you have a description of the current situation in the book I'm talking about now, and it's beautiful. It's just, I want to put all my faith into what you're saying. And you have a description of the economics of what we need to move to. And I'm excited about that. But then kind of in the middle, it seems like, and I haven't quite finished, there's this brief phrase that says, we need to make this change. And I'm curious about how you're going to imagine that we coming together, where we collectively choose this new system and rise to this different way of being. And to me, that's the key piece. I feel like the essence of what needs to happen in what you're describing is a collective thinking, talking, working together, and choosing together in new institutions that you've so beautifully described.
Yeah. I mean, I guess if you're talking about the actual process of social and political change and how does that happen, I mean, there's different theories about that. I think that real fundamental change happens in a kind of organic, spontaneous way. Like Occupy, you know, it didn't start with meticulous planning and everybody agreeing on a vision and everything like that. People just were infected by an idea. And the time hadn't quite come yet for that idea to really spread throughout the entire population, as it did maybe in Egypt or something. Because normal is still working for most people in America. Or if it's not working, it's at least possible to pretend that it's going to start working again soon. But if, you know, if we have another financial crisis, and we will, and it's more severe than this one. Like, for example, one of the things I've been thinking about is the idea of a debt strike, where enough people reach this point of desperation where the idea of a debt strike just spreads virally and people just stop making their payments, and really, really quickly, things fall apart. And I'm not sure I want to go too much into this historical stuff, like about how revolutions actually happen and how the leaders of revolutions often find themselves being swept by events that are much bigger than they could have possibly anticipated or planned, and they have the feeling that they're flying by the seat of their pants and kind of riding the wave. Like, I think we're going to enter times of chaos, and then from the chaos, things will emerge. And right now, we're kind of preparing the ground for that by having these conversations and by creating visions and creating pilot models of things on a small scale and working out ideas, trying out permaculture and eco-villages and alternative currencies and different kinds of democracy and open space technology and all of these different things that are marginal today but will become the new normal. I mean, we could talk a long time about, as social and political activists, like what do we do right now? And that could be a fruitful conversation, but I think I also want to bring together the world of the activist and the world of the spiritual practitioner, which have been sundered for a long time with quite a lot of mutual animosity even, which could take the form of get off your meditation cushion and get out there and do something about it. Don't you know that mm-hmm. the rainforests are disappearing? Or on the other side, you know, how can you go out there and do something when you hardly even know yourself and you're just going to replicate your shadow mm-hmm. and project it onto the world? And so there's these kind of two different camps. Now they're coming together, and I've been meeting a lot of older activists, people who were radicals in the 60s. Now they've come to meditation and spiritual practice, and they want to bring these two worlds together. Let's have another question.
Okay. Here's Lawrence. You have the mic.
Hi, Charles.
Hi.
I've been really impacted by your work, and I love Ascent of Humanity and Sacred Economics and all the talks you've given online. I just wanted to say I think that for me personally, I've seen that you have to have a collapse in your own life before you can recognize the collapse of large-scale systems. Like mm-hmm. for me, I broke up with my girlfriend last year, and we had a very deep connection. And I recognized that my like almost infinite need to deeply connect. And I could see the like disorganization and disassembly of like our social organization as a society. And I kind of got interested in the way that we were psychologically built because I have a background in evolutionary psychology. And I almost think that like here in Michigan, the Ottawa people lived in like small-scale tribal villages, and their aunts and their uncles were considered mothers and fathers, and their cousins were brothers and sisters, and by their reckoning, a whole tribal unit could be a family unit. Now, I, having been raised in the nuclear family model, which is by all accounts a modern invention, I find myself having social difficulty interacting with people with like an open heart to actually trust them to be completely myself and to love them in that moment when they're a stranger, because I haven't been trained or raised in that type of society. And it's a little bit of a difficulty for me. And the same thing happens with language acquisition, for like there's critical stages in development, and if you don't get taught these particular social skills, it's going to be a long learning process. So for me, it's every time I meet someone, I'm practicing, but it's a difficult path.
Yeah, we are, you could say, born into separation, where a lot of the psychological components of a complete human being are missing from us. Just the fact that most of the people that we interact with and who meet our needs for life's basics and for life's pleasures as well are strangers. The people who grow our food, the people who make our clothes, people who sing our songs, the people who take care of our bodies, they're mostly people we don't know by face and by story. And that leaves us with a kind of deficit of being, you could say. And to recover that, you know, how do we recover that? In a way, it's natural to distrust strangers because you don't know them. And in tribal times, a stranger, someone not of the tribe, was not really part of your constellation of self. Everyone in the tribe who knew you and you knew them, they were part of you. They were so close, just like kind of your family is now, your nuclear family, you know, they're part of self. What happens to them, you care about that. But that's not true of a stranger. And so when we're talking about healing separation, it's not as simple as just kind of throwing ourselves into blind trust of total strangers. But it's really in rebuilding all of the different layers of self that exist between the solitary ego and cosmic consciousness. So there's the level of family, and we still have some of that intact, although even the nuclear family has been eroded in the last generation or two. But then there's also the level of extended family. Then there's the level of community and the level of place, you know, the level of bioregion, the land, all of these things we need to rebuild. And it's not simply a matter of a shift of perception, but it's a matter of enacting that shift of perception in ways that feel real. I mean, that's kind of a long preface, but one way that I write about a lot, as you know, is reforging these interpersonal connections through gift economics and through gift cosmology, seeing ourselves as bearers of gifts and entering into gift relationships with people and with nature too, and with the planet and with everything, and rebuilding the larger self. Because let's put it this way, when somebody gives something to you, then there's a bond created because you want to give them back something. Or maybe you want to give something to the community of which they're a part, but you feel kind of like I owe you one or I owe somebody one. And it's not like this obligation like owe in the sense of debt where I have to do it otherwise. Something bad's going to happen to me. I'm going to get sued. I'm going to go bankrupt. I'm going to lose my house. You know, it's a desire to give back. And so someone gives us something to you and you desire to give back to them. And then maybe you give something back to them and then they want to give back to you again. It's not a transaction, but it's, you know, maybe you give them one kind of gift and they give you another kind of gift and you become dependent on each other. And this dependency is actually what we're craving when we crave community. We want to be needed and we want to need and we want to step into the fullness of all our relationships. So I guess to return to the theme of our session today, you know, one of the invisible habits of separation would be the desire to be independent, to not need anybody, and to have no one really need us either. But maybe it's okay for some people to need us, but I really don't want to need anybody. I don't want to depend on anybody's gifts or anybody's charity. And that's really an illusion that we can ever be independent. We're always dependent for everything we need. And the amount we receive things that we couldn't possibly make ourselves and we couldn't possibly earn, like air and water and this whole society that keeps every one of us alive. You know, today, though, our system obscures, with the ideology of money, it obscures our primal neediness and therefore our relatedness. And so we live as if we were these independent people who could pay for everything. Susan, I've been droning on a while.
It was when you said as if, because I think that habit of living as if carries over. We live as if we're interdependent, not realizing that we are, whether we like it or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just want to make it really practical. Like, I think that everybody reaches this point where you realize I'm not fully giving of my gifts, or there's a new gift that's welling up in me, and I want to start giving from that gift, and I haven't been.
Mm-hmm.
And my life won't be tolerable until I start. And this feeling starts out as kind of a dull ache, or this feeling of discomfort, of not being at ease. But then it grows and grows until it becomes intolerable. And that's the point when people leave jobs or say yes to opportunities that might have been a bit too risky, a bit too crazy before, but they start doing new things.
Is that what happened to you when you were translating?
Yeah. You've heard the story, but maybe some of the people here haven't. But I was a translator in Taiwan, and I was making good money, you know. I was pretty much at the top of my profession. And at first, it was really challenging, and, you know, I was developing all kinds of new skills and learning a lot, but it became less and less challenging. And I started to do it more and more just for the money. And then I had this moment sitting in a meeting with some software company people talking about a new product feature, which I was going to help them. I was writing a brochure for them or something. And I just looked around the room and everybody was so animated and they were taking it so seriously, this product feature. And I looked around and I said to myself, I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you guys care? You guys look like you care, but I'm just pretending to care. Maybe I felt superior to them for a few moments. You know, I was kind of like the cynical, above-it-all person. But then the horror of the situation arose in me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when do I get to do something in my life that I actually care about? Or do I just live the life I'm paid to live? And I think what I was feeling was the upwelling of this desire to give of my gifts in a way that was meaningful to me.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, I mean, I did cling on a little longer to that profession, but it became impossible eventually, and I had to stop doing it. And it wasn't because I had some noble altruistic impulse. It was just intolerable.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the most selfish thing you can do in the sense of what brings you the most happiness is to really, like, give fully. But there's a lot of barriers to that, more invisible habits.
Yeah, my name's Christian, and you can choose to ignore this question if you'd like. I think that there's this anthropological principle of like Dunbar's number of 150 individuals that the human brain can kind of juggle relationships with.
Right.
And I think that to me, that kind of models are, you know, evolutionary history, but it models maybe where we're going towards in terms of an evolution or society. But you talk about economies of scale and like large scale solutions, but I almost feel like money replaces relationships And even the time bank you mentioned in Sacred Economics almost quantifies something that shouldn't be quantified, which is just a relationship and giving and taking freely. I really like the eco-village model, and you mentioned that, because within that village, the social emotions can moderate that economy, and that if someone's giving freely, then people feel gratitude towards them, and you needn't even quantify it at all. And perhaps maybe that's what we should be focusing on is in our own life developing relationships, which needn't be quantified, and just be open and trusting and deepening those.
Yeah, I think time banking, it's beneficial when it brings people together to do things for each other that they hadn't been doing before. I've heard from some time bank folks, you know, who've been doing it for a while. They say at first, you know, yeah, like everything's being quantified, you know, and I mowed your lawn, I get 2 hours of credit, and then you babysat and we got 3 hours of credit and all that kind of stuff, and everyone's keeping track. But eventually when people get more deeply into these relationships, then they stop keeping track, you know. So I think a time bank on the local level, it's kind of transitional toward what you're describing, where you don't have to keep track because everything's happening in a social witnessing. In a real community, you know, a tribe or an old-time village, you know, or even like small-town America 100 years ago, everybody knew who was being generous and who wasn't, who was contributing and who wasn't, who was in special need and who wasn't, because along with these gifts, gifts in a broad sense, you know, people doing things for each other, along with them, stories circulated as well. People talked about each other. So today we have really no way to circulate gifts very much beyond the family level. And we have less and less of a way to circulate stories, too. Now, that might be changing with, you know, Facebook and stuff like that. But for the last generation or two, more and more, we've gotten our stories remotely from mass media. We know more about the life of Kim Kardashian than our next-door neighbor. I'm sure my neighbors know more about her than about me. So we're getting our stories remotely, and we're getting the things we need remotely, and so we have no way to be tied together. And so I think time banking is a way to kind of reconstruct that. But yeah, definitely, like, that's not the ultimate direction that we want to go. That's not our destination. We want to not have to keep track, at least on a local level. Now, I don't advocate going back to the hunter-gatherer past and kind of discarding all of history. I think that we've gone through all of this for a reason. So I think that, yeah, on the one hand, we do need to rebuild these smaller levels of self, the community level especially, the level of people whose story you know directly. That's always been with us, and we need that. But I think there are other levels beyond that. Like, there's the level of Dunbar's number squared. So the people that are in your town, that if you don't know them personally, you know somebody who knows them. And so you kind of get their stories remotely. I mean, you can take it up to the global level. And on that level, you need some way to replace the social function of stories that, you know, allowed everybody to know who's contributing and who is in need. One way I describe money and justify money is that it performs that function. It's like the signaling molecule in a body that says, hey, this tissue needs some of this. This tissue needs some of that. We need something like that on the global level, I think. Although I think that the domain of money will and should shrink, and that many things that we use money for today, we will no longer use money for. But I think it'll still exist.
Thank you, Christian. And if somebody else has something, comment, question that they'd like to address to Charles, please press 5-star.
You are listening to Sequitur, a production of Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. Sequitur is archived at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action.
From one extreme to the other, our cultural enhancement is as new as tomorrow. Millennial musicians Julian White and Dana Goodwin combined some DIY and synthesizer effects with features of Ableton Live digital audio workstation to embellish the song Hide and Seek by Imogen Heap. We're calling the resulting track Heap, which you're about to hear. And I'll embed the Imogen Heap song on the Sequitur Interbeing page at panina.org. So here is Heap by Julian White and Dana Goodwin.
Yeah.
That was Heap by Julian White and Dana Goodwin. And now, let's return to May of 2012 and the Embodied Compassion teleconference.
And here's Raven. You have a mic. Go ahead.
Hi, Charles. It's super exciting to be speaking with you.
Hi.
Hi there. I read Sacred Economics and I've been following your work. And I have to say, I'm just super grateful. I felt like a bit of a pioneer in the wilderness, and it's so good to be resonating with you, and all the things that you speak about just really hit home for me.
Thank you.
So my question at the quote-unquote practical level, have there been any techniques that you've used to heal invisible habits of separation? I mean, you've said before that, and I can see that we aren't separate, so arguably on one level, we're already not separate, but in terms of sort of resisting the pull of conduct, do you have any sort of daily technical practices or helpful techniques that you use?
Mm-hmm. Maybe what I'll do is I'll go through a list of some invisible habits of separation. Sometimes just naming them can be useful because then you can kind of build your own practice around them. Like you might just start noticing every time you do that. Yeah, I'll just name some invisible habits of separation, maybe invisible for some people and visible for others. One habit would be, okay, anything that is based around judgment is a habit of separation. So, for example, the habit of feeling superior to all those people in their SUVs who vote for Republicans, they just don't get it. And what's wrong with them? That mindset, finding fault with other people, or going over everything you did to make sure that it is justifiable. Like going over your day, what did I just do, and was that good or not? Was I good or not? A habit of separation would be, right at this moment, to be a little ashamed of yourself for doing that, or to be congratulating yourself for not doing that. That would be a habit. That's self-judgment. Trying hard to be good in whatever way that is, and giving yourself credit for your progress toward being good. Now, why is that a habit of separation? I'll answer that in a minute. Another one would be to value hard things more than easy things. That comes up in our speech when we say, well, it would have been really easy for me just to hang up on the guy, but instead I stayed in the line and I was really patient. Right? I did the hard thing, and that's the good thing, because the easy thing's the bad thing. Mm-hmm. So really what that comes from is the war against the self. The overcoming of nature, overcoming of our own nature, which mirrors the overcoming of the planetary nature. And it's a kind of separation, too, because, well, when you give yourself credit for doing the hard thing, basically you're implying that, you know, not everybody would have done the hard thing. I might not have done the hard thing, and some people don't do the hard thing. And so those people who did just hang up or who are still on drugs, you know, or the people who are giving other motorists the finger or doing all these awful things, it's because they didn't do the hard thing, because they didn't try hard enough. It's because I'm doing something and they're not doing it. And if I were that person, I would be doing better than them because I try harder or because I'm more surrendered or because I'm this or I'm that. Basically, it's a way of saying, if I were you, I wouldn't be doing what you're doing. And really what that is saying is, I am fundamentally different from you. And that's not consistent with the truth that we're awakening to, which is that we're not fundamentally separate, which is that if I were in your position, in the totality of your circumstances, I would be doing exactly as you're doing, because we're not separate, because we're the same being walking through the world from a different perspective. We're looking out from different eyes, but we're the same being. So you can see how the mythology of separation and the state of being of separation flowers forth in so many different ways. So if you want to build a practice around it, well, one thing I do, and it's pretty directly related to this, is when I come across some kind of behavior or some kind of action that seems to me to be reprehensible, and when I catch myself thinking, I would never do that if I were that person, I'm better than that, then my practice is to try to imagine what it would take for me to do that, what it would take for me to do as that person's doing. Like, what would I have to be born into? What would my life experience have to be? What would it take to make me into that person? How can I inhabit that person's world? I wrote a little book called Transformational Weight Loss, and I basically got into the mind of an obese person and did that. Like, what would it be like to walk into a room and the first thing people notice is how fat you are? And what kind of judgments do they have? And what kind of judgments would I have? And what would it take for me to do that? You know, and I really like deeply inhabited that. And I wrote this book. And I keep getting letters from obese people saying, how do you know what it's like to be in my head? And it's really, I mean, it's just called compassion, you know, and it comes from that practice. What would it take? I mean, I even did it with this woman, Andrea Yates, the Texan woman who drowned her 5 kids in the bathtub 10 years ago. I had little kids at that time, you know, and it was so shocking to me. It's one of those things that really got under my skin, and I just had to make sense of it, because if I couldn't make sense of it, it meant that there was a monster in the world. It meant that there was this other thing that would always remain alien, and the world wouldn't be complete. So I had to understand, I had to know what her experience was like. And it keeps coming up. I came across the story of this Iraqi family. The youngest son of the family, who was 18, he was an artist, and he was kidnapped and tortured to death in the most brutal imaginable way. When they found his body, his fingers had been clipped off. And I just thought, okay, what would it take for me to do that to somebody? Like, where are the torturers right now in the journey of the human experience? What space are they inhabiting? Because, I mean, here's another habit, you know, to write somebody off as a monster. Because from there comes basically fascism. Then the solution then is to kill the monsters, or to eliminate the monsters, to eliminate evil, and to purify the world, purify the race. I mean, it's the same kind of logic. And we know where that takes us. And on the personal psychological level, it takes us to just as bad a place when we say that, well, there's these bad things inside of me that I have to suppress, that I have to conquer, that I have to defeat, that I have to extirpate. And I just won't even allow myself to think that. And so we exclude these shadow parts of ourselves and deny them. And then, of course, they come out in uncontrollable ways. I'll pause with that.
Is that it for you, Raven?
Sure, I appreciate that. It sounds like bringing presence. So, like you said, even just naming, becoming aware of the various patterns is one way of allowing for some change.
Yeah, especially when it comes to judgmentality. Just becoming aware of it, like, oh yeah, I'm being judgmental. That is much more effective than getting judgmental about your judgmentality. And think, how could I do that? What's wrong with me? You know, I'm going to stop doing that. Because if I don't stop doing it, then I'm a bad person. I'm a judgmental person. And then another part of you say, no, I'm not judgmental. And you get defensive. And that's all judgmentality. And so I think that the way to dissolve it is not even to try to dissolve it, but it's just to be aware of it. And then at some point, you're like, yeah, that's not really me anymore. You know, maybe that judgmental voice is still there yammering away, but you just don't pay attention to it. You recognize it. Oh, yeah, that's you. But it doesn't drag us into that emotional state.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I didn't catch your name, but your phone number ends in 49. You've had your hand up and down a few times. I'm handing you a mic.
Yes, this is Holly.
Hi, Holly.
Hi, Holly.
Hey. So you just went over some practice for judgment of other people, and I'm wondering what you have a practice for judgment of self. You know, you mentioned invisible habits of going over your day, was I good enough? And if you could speak to that a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with self, it's a little harder, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have this ideology of our innate badness. It's in religion, of course, with original sin, you know, but it's implicit in science, too, in biology, which says that your basic nature is to maximize your reproductive self-interest, to take advantage of other beings for your own benefit, which translated into today's terms means money. That's what your self-interest is. That's what your security is. And it says basically you're a selfish being. And if we accept that, I mean, that's basically a definition of evil, which is that you only care about yourself and you'll use anything else as a tool to benefit yourself. That's the definition of evil. And so in order not to be evil, then you have to go against your nature. And so you have to cultivate this other non-natural part, which we give different names to, like the spirit or the mind or the consciousness or the civilized part, that we have to cultivate. To cultivate that, we have to deny the flesh, deny pleasure, deny desire, fight against ourselves, discipline ourselves. And so it's this constant war against the self. It's a very deep habit. And I think, in addition to just bringing the light of awareness to that habit, we can also train new habits of trusting desire and allowing desire and allowing pleasure and following it and making choices based on that. And it can be really scary to do something without any justification except because I want to. But if it appeals to you, you could make that into a practice where when it comes to a choice that you're struggling over or that you don't feel clarity, to give yourself that permission to say, I'm going to do it just because I want to. Mm. Like, you're almost not allowed to do that. I remember when I was in my previous marriage, anything I wanted to do, I had to think of justifications for. Like, I wanted to go for a walk right now, but then Patsy was going to be stuck at home with the kids, you know? And so I have to justify, oh, I really need a walk right now because I haven't exercised for 2 days. Or I'm just totally frustrated right now. Or I deserve a walk right now. I just washed all the dishes. And then pretending that that's why I was doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And to say, well, I'm just going to do it because I want to. If you're in a relationship where that is not okay, where you're in this kind of wrestling match of martyrdom or justification, then you're kind of breaking the rules of the relationship when you say, I'm just going to do it because I want to. And the other person will be like, not in so many words, will say, you can't do that. You have to justify that, because that kind of freedom and that kind of self-trust is threatening. And it goes against a lot of our training. One practice I might suggest then is in an area that you feel ready to do something just because you want to. And you'll find that the more that you trust desire, the more moral your behavior becomes, actually, contrary to the fear that if you give license to desire, you'll end up being licentious. You know, you'll end up being dissolute, and you'll end up on the couch eating chocolate bonbons in front of the TV all day. You know, if I just did what I wanted to, right? Because we don't trust desire. We don't think that desire is going to lead us to a beautiful place. But to counter that, you say, well, what are my deepest desires? What do I really want? If I want money, what's the desire underneath money? What do I really want? One of the biggest desires that I found in my life is I want to give fully of my gifts. And maybe you've had this kind of experience too, where you want to do something magnanimous, or you want to volunteer your time to something, or you want to do something generous. And then there's that voice that says, you can't do that. You can't afford to. What'll happen to you? So it's not that desire is holding you back from doing these beautiful things. It's that there's something else opposing desire, a fear that's opposing desire. So one practice is to trust ourselves more and to listen more to desire, and especially in those times where it's all confusing, to cut through it all, say, I'm just going to do what I want to do because I want to do it. Does that sound like fun?
Yeah. I'm actually pretty good at that part, but my whole life like kind of just dissolved, and uh-huh. I'm feeling this aching to like, okay, where's the next place I give my gift? And mm-hmm. just kind of like struggling with self-doubt or fear of failure. So it's more about that for me, like how do I find the place to give?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, life falls apart and then a new life starts. But in between, there's this kind of empty space where a lot is actually happening. A lot of integration, things are brewing, you know, things are gestating. And I think that it's important to be patient during that time and to understand like what special time it is, because you're going to be really, really busy in a couple of years. And you're going to look back on this time, which if we don't battle it, can be really sweet, like really kind of intimate with self, you know, really it's kind of like this coming home time and always a part of the hero's journey, you know, the return to the womb. It's only called depression when we fight it, this time of in-betweenness. Sometimes I draw on the biblical analogy, you know, where the Israelites are free from slavery, finally. They've escaped Egypt, but they don't immediately arrive in the promised land either. They have to wander around for 40 years, even though the promised land isn't actually very far away. It doesn't take 40 years to get there. It takes a couple weeks, actually, to walk to the promised land from Egypt, you know. But they wander for 40 years until they find the land of milk and honey. And I think that that is kind of a template for the transition out of slavery. Slavery meaning doing something that isn't really your life, or that's no longer your life. I mean, it started in the story as a refuge. Egypt started as a refuge. And that certainly has been true in my life. where a job or a relationship that had become slavery didn't start out that way. It started out as some kind of refuge, but then eventually it became slavery. And the in-between zone lasted, for me, many years.
Holly?
Yeah, thank you. That was helpful.
Good.
Okay, anybody else? 5-star on your keypad will raise your hand, and I'll hand you a mic. Breath or two.
Yeah, I always feel weird about it. I mean, like, this is a really weird situation if you think about it, you know?
It is.
I could be imagining all this, actually.
Yes, it really is very much like talking into a pillow, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't want to pretend to be qualified to give anyone advice either, you know?
Yeah. I like this conversational mode. This is great.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see any more hands up, Charles, so if you want to go on and put another segment on the table, that would be a wonderful thing.
What's on your mind?
Oh, my goodness. It just keeps coming and coming, and then we get past it, and it's not relevant anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You said a moment ago when you were talking with Holly, it's not called depression unless you fight it. And a little bit earlier than that, we were talking about giving of our gifts just because we want to.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking, you know what, that's what gets people manic diagnoses. I wonder if you can say anything about that. People get real suspicious of people who give things away for no reason.
Yeah, you know, sometimes I get letters from people who basically tell their story. A couple of years ago, they say, I just decided to give away all my money. Sometimes it's after they read something of mine, but often it's just like they spontaneously, I got a letter from Holland from a guy like that. You know, he just said to give away everything. And since he did that, his life just blossomed in such an incredible way. Basically, miracles happen around him. You know, people are inspired. People are giving him huge amounts of money, which he then gives away to somebody else, you know, and he's just at this nexus of flow and synchronicity. This one guy wrote, and he was from Michigan, I think, and he just, every night, he would start driving around and help homeless people. Like, just drive around for a few hours every night, driving people to homeless shelters, you know, giving away money, you know, just like basically going around and being like the Santa Claus.
Mm.
And in order to hide it from his wife, he pretended that he had a drinking problem because that was more acceptable than just going and giving away the same amount of money he would have spent on drinking.
Mm.
And so it's true, like, it's really challenging. Now, there is such a thing as an inappropriate gift because, like I said before, a gift creates a bond, you know, and it creates an obligation. There's a whole art around giving gifts and a whole set of social conventions that differ from culture to culture, but be inappropriate. Like if you went to the wedding of a distant relative and you gave them an envelope stuffed with $10,000, they'd be like, why are you doing this?
Is it hot?
Right. Like it would be inappropriate. You know, there's an appropriate gift that is based on your status and their status and your relationship and all that kind of stuff. And this is an art that we can kind of intuitively sense, but we've lost a lot of its nuance. I mean, compared to, you know, even Japan, where there's still a lot of gift-giving culture, we've lost a lot of that. But still, we can sense an inappropriate gift. So that might be part of it, but I think really that way of being, we fear it because we want it. We want to be that open. We want to be that trusting that what we give will come back to us.
Mm-hmm.
But we're also afraid of it. You know, fear and desire are very closely linked because the thing that we want the most is to transcend the boundaries of our world, to grow, to be bigger, to recover some of our lost being. And that's also what we fear, to transcend the boundaries of our world. Dying, for example, is something we fear. And fear isn't the enemy necessarily because growth and transcendence of ourselves happens according to its natural rhythm and timing.
Yeah.
So I think it's perfectly appropriate for me to have a fear reaction when I'm driving on an icy road because I'm not ready right now to transcend that particular boundary.
How does connecting with nature inform you as far as your capacity to build community and build these mutual relationships of social obligation with others?
I'm not sure how to answer that right now without intellectualizing it too much.
Can you bring it to practices in,
uh-huh.
in your life? How do you connect with nature and what does it do for you?
You know, there's an African tribe, and they say the jungle is good to think. I don't know if you've had this experience. It happens a lot after I've been pulling weeds or after I've been picking raspberries, like in the wild, or looking for herbs. Like, but if I'm like where I'm really paying attention to plants or animals or something, then, you know, I go home, I close my eyes, and I can see them vividly in my mind's eye without any effort to conjure up the images. They're kind of like imprinted on my brain. if I were speaking to you live, I'd look around and I'd say, do you guys know what I'm talking about? And most people would probably nod their heads. When anybody gives attention to any other being, you kind of take that being into you a little bit. It becomes part of you.
Mm.
And that's a kind of food that I think we desperately need. So one practice that it's very elementary, and I think that, you know, when we talk about reconnecting with nature, it has to be more than nature as a spectacle. Nature as this thing that you go into, you relate to with one or two senses, and then you come back out again. Like, we need to give to nature as well as to receive from nature.
Mm.
We need to enter a gift relationship with nature. But that said, one practice that I find quite powerful is to go into nature and give full attention to something. It could be like the forest. It could be one little leaf. It could be a bug. It could be a frog. One time I went hiking with my son, Matthew, and there was like this frog. And we just squatted down and looked at the frog for about 10 or 15 minutes. I just told Matthew, just like, give it your full attention. And afterward, we could both, if we closed our eyes, the frog was right there. We gave the frog the gift of attention. And attention can be a gift. In fact, it could be the most primal gift. People like attention, especially kids. They're more in touch with this need, but we all need it. And so that frog imprinted itself, like, on my brain. It became part of me. And I think that it delivers a kind of a medicine that way. So you can go into any little patch of woods near you and give something in that woods, or give the entirety of the woods, or the pattern of leaves against the sky or something. Just give it your full attention, or give appreciative attention to a certain tree. And you will probably receive some kind of gift in return. Sometimes I do that if I have some kind of question, something unresolved that I can't figure out, or something that's hurting me. And so I'll go with that need present for me, and sometimes I'll get an answer that feels like it was that tree that gave me that answer, or that cloud that gave me that answer. Clouds like attention. And so now I'm kind of going into this kind of primitive shamanic worldview where every being is a sentient being, even clouds. You know, this is something that the childish part in us knows. Like that cloud, it has thoughts and feelings, and so does that tree, and so does that rock. You know, it has sentience. This is something that the indigenous self knows, and that every indigenous culture affirms, but we're living in a mythology that denies that and says, no, it's just composed of generic protons, neutrons, and electrons that happen to be in this configuration, but that's it. That's what our worldview tells us, but we know better than that. And so this is, again, another, you could say it's a technology of non-separation. How do you get answers to questions? Well, one way is to ask a tree, and you do that by offering attention. And whether or not you have a question, you cannot help but receive something when you give full attention. It's one of the most powerful things you can do, interpersonally too.
Mm-hmm. If you can do it, there's an opening of the self to the fullness of life. That maybe that's right. What I personally get out of nature, because I know nature's not going to slap me back. You know, I can pay attention with impunity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And be received. That's it.
Yeah, you know, like, sometimes people don't want anyone to pay attention to them. You know, you want to be left alone, and sometimes some part of nature might feel the same way. So I think it's good to be respectful and to tap into your intuitions about that.
I like the clarity of nature. If there's a part of nature that is not ready to receive me, it lets me know in unmistakable terms, and people don't always do that.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if anyone else has had something come bubbling alive in them. If so, oh, there's somebody at the very bottom of the list. Your number ends in 237, and you have a mic.
Hi, this is Judith.
Hi, Judith.
Hi, Judith.
Hi, guys. I'm really enjoying this call, and my question is, Charles, I'm wanting to get clear if I'm getting you right, because when I take your idea about, you know, going with what you want, when I take that and then I think about what you said about, you know, non-judgment,
mm-hmm.
well, what comes up for me, one of the things is, like, for example, our exploration of the tar sands, you know, and how we're pillaging the planet and causing runaway climate change. And it's so massive, this project. And, you know, we want that oil. And I'm wondering, like, are you saying that that's okay? Because we need to, is it like you're saying we need to accept that as just, you know, our destiny, that we're going to really need to get to a place of crisis, you know, worse than we're already in?
Thanks for asking that question. I'm first just going to observe a little bit about the terms of the question. Like, you know, so we're exploiting the Albertan tar sands and destroying thousands of miles of tundra and indigenous livelihoods. And are we just going to say that that's okay? So for one thing, like, what does it mean to say that it's okay or not okay? Basically, it's saying that there's something more important, and whether this is true or not, you know, I just want to point out how it comes back down to should and shouldn't, good and bad, and we should only do things that are good, that are okay, that are justifiable, according to what? I'm not going to analyze that a whole lot, but I wanted to just kind of highlight that. But I think that what's going on with our endless appetite for more oil is that it's not actually what we want, but it's a substitute for what we want. And the whole consumer culture that drives the oil industry is a substitute for what we really want. What we really want is its connection. You know, we want to reunite with all of these lost parts of ourselves. We want community. We want intimacy with nature. And we don't have that. So we have this longing, this need, this desire to reconnect, but we don't have easy access to what we really need and what we really want. So instead, you can buy an iPod, or instead you can get a bigger house, or a faster car, or have a bigger bank account. And these things are substitutes for our real needs. And because of that, they're addictive. Anything that substitutes for something that you really need is addictive, because no matter how much of it you have, the real need still isn't met.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that if we trusted our desires even more, then we would stop consuming so much of what we really don't need. So I think that the answer is actually to trust desire more and not less. I'm not saying that, like, it's an all or nothing thing. I think that we also have a natural sense of what the appropriate next step is. Just as our gifts unfold according to a natural rhythm and process, so also does the discovery of our desires. And so there might be a time where it is appropriate to be very cautious and to hold back on gratifying something, like, you're not sure, do I really want that or not? But I think that in general, what we need is to follow our deepest desires, our real desires. If you ask anybody, what do you really, really want in life the most? Even people who want money, yes, well, why do you want money? And they want, maybe they want this, they want that. But at some point, almost everybody I've asked says, well, I want to give it away. I want to do great things with it. So I think that our distrust of desire is based on the way that our culture displaces desire onto things that we don't really want, that don't meet our deepest needs.
Well, on that note, my good people, it's almost the top of the hour, and on behalf of the 28 people on this call, I don't think I know half of them, which is wonderful. So glad to be able to connect people who are putting our shoulders to the work that needs to be done in the world. Thank you very much, Charles, and thank you very much, participants. Charles, I said it in the introduction, and I'll say it again now for the purpose of the recording. You have turned my life around, and I am infinitely grateful to you for what you've brought to the world and for your willingness to keep bringing it in all kinds of different contexts, even ones that aren't as comfortable for you as others. Thank you very much.
Thank you for bringing us together. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
And thank you for joining Sequitur for what might end up being an important piece of countercultural history. Special thanks to Charles Eisenstein for all that he is and does. To the 6 callers who brought forward questions and comments to prompt his provocative wisdom. To Julian White and Dana Goodwin for the edgy musical gift of Heap.
And to Zimt
for the Sequitur theme music. Until next time, this is Susan Livingston.
Connects us is one.